Hi, this is Dr. Nick Hayward. This podcast contains no medical advice. The discussion aims to raise awareness of the long-haul impact of coronavirus and COVID-19. For disease updates, please go to the World Health Organization's webpages. Thank you for listening. Please like and share this story widely, as it may support other long-haulers. I wish you well. Hi, this is Dr. Nick Hayward. I'm here with COVID-19 long haul stories. Today it's Laura's story. Laura, please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you were before COVID-19 even came along.
Hi, well, I'm 29 years old. I'm a doctor in Colombia, and I've always been a very active person. I was running at least 9 obstacle course races a day. I was running at least 15 miles a week. I was preparing for a marathon, the New York City Marathon, actually, that I wanted to do this year, which unfortunately had to be canceled. I practice jiu-jitsu. I do Pilates. I've just always been super active. I play soccer. This is like anything that you can imagine that's outdoors, I would be there doing it, which, you know, has changed since I first got sick with COVID-19 back in March, which has been, you know, a little bit difficult to deal with the aftermath of what the virus has left me.
Would you be willing to take us back to that time in March, around the time of diagnosis, and tell us a little bit about your story of what happened then?
Yeah, so it was very scary times. At the time, it was the beginning of March. We already knew that a pandemic was going on. We thought there was only one case in New York City. We were quarantining since March 4th, I believe. My husband, who works in the city, was sent home to work from home since March 4th. So we have been quarantining since then. And then, you know, my husband was the one who was doing the grocery shopping at the time. He was wearing his mask every time, but most people around him were not wearing a mask. Then one day, you know, I think it was March 16th, he developed a fever. So we were like, you know, there were only very few patients around here, so we didn't think he was going to be one of those patients, but we took the precautions just in case. We kept quarantining, hoping he went to see a doctor at the time. And they told him, like, no, it's probably, we're almost sure that this is not COVID because there's so little patients right now. And then we still went to get tested 4 or 5 days later, both of us, because, you know, we just want to make sure this is not it. And the next day after I got tested, I developed a fever too. And I was like, you know what? This has to be it. This is COVID. And had a fever. I had pain in my whole body. I had horrible headaches. I had a really bad cough. I was sneezing like crazy. I was short of breath. I could not get out of bed to go to the bathroom without getting short of breath. Could not go up my stairs. It was horrible. It was really bad. But, you know, after like 4 or 5 days, we get a call back. They said, yeah, you guys were positive for COVID. I remember we called the doctor to let him know, like, hey, you were in contact with a COVID patient, so you should probably quarantine yourself. And he was in awe. He could not believe that he had been in contact with a COVID patient. Anyway, at the time I thought, like, you know what, if this is COVID, I'm glad I already got it. It's out of the way now. I already got sick. Now I don't have anything to worry about, because we were always with that mental fear of getting COVID. And having lived it, even though it was hard, I was like, you know, this is it. I'm done. And I started to feel a little bit better. And after like a week and a half, I was like, you know what, I'm going to exercise, because it always helps me feel better after I'm like getting over a viral infection or bacterial infection. So I decided to exercise. And I, like I mentioned, I was already feeling better. And after I exercised, I just developed like tachycardia, like a really rapid heart rate that didn't leave me after that. And then 6 months later, it never left. I don't know if it was because of the exercise, or some research now showing that maybe exercise could be detrimental for COVID and maybe could help the virus replicate faster. Like, we don't know. We don't know yet what's going on. But I remember specifically after that day of working out, my life was never the same. So You know, I contacted, I had to have telemedicine appointments, telehealth appointments at the time, because obviously nobody wanted to see a COVID patient in person, which I understand, but, you know, I'm here at home suffering. The cough was horrible. I remember going to sleep at night with my husband, and I was so terrified of going to sleep because I really believed that I was not going to wake up the next day, or I believed that my husband was not going to wake up the next day. And you would hear all these stories of the patients who went to the hospital, they send them home, and then they didn't get through the night. They passed away during the night. So,
my word. So let's just summarize briefly there. So you're 29, you're a doctor yourself. And you're there, just remind me, on the East Coast of the United States, is that correct?
Yes, on the East Coast.
Excellent. And you contracted this virus, COVID-19, at a time where there were relatively few cases. So people were skeptical, but hey, the test came back. And you and your husband were in such a bad way at the time that you felt like you might not survive. And considering you're a clinician and you must have worked with some very unwell people, how long did that kind of period last? I mean, for how long were you worried about that?
That was for about at least three weeks. You know, we were told that after 2 weeks, you would be better, you would recover, you shouldn't have any symptoms after 2 weeks. We both had a mild case, and my husband had a little bit less symptoms, but we both had a cough. We were coughing all night long. We couldn't sleep because we were coughing all night long. And I would wake up to his cough, and I was so scared. I was really scared. And I would I have a pulse oximeter, you know, that checks your blood oxygen. And I would, when he was sleeping, I would wake up from his cough and I would like put it on his finger just to make sure that he was saturating okay. Because I know that this disease, like, it can evolve so rapidly that, you know, it's within hours, it can go from mild to severe. You know, you can develop ARDS, like nothing. So it was very, very scary. Like I had bad insomnia because I just didn't want to go to sleep. I was scared.
So over a 3 week period, every night, you're actually concerned to the extent that you may not wake up in the morning. I genuinely cannot begin to imagine how that feels. Some of us have had, you know, illness in the past, particularly like a respiratory condition, a certain virus maybe, but you know, it's very rare to ever feel that unwell. That just reminds me, some have been comparing this virus, coronavirus, COVID-19, to influenza or the flu. What's your opinion on that?
It's funny because my husband actually developed the flu in January this year. He actually got the flu. I didn't get the flu, and you know, That's when you, just there, you compare the infectivity rate of one and the other. We were both living in the same house, sleeping in the same bed, kissing, and I did not get sick. I did not get influenza. Well, he was sick. That's one of the things that I already see that could be a little bit different, and people keep comparing. But no, one is more contagious than the other. You know, SARS-CoV-2 is more contagious than influenza. To go back to the flu, you know, it's also a different kind of disease. You know, the COVID, it's still like the clinical spectrum of COVID, it's still evolving. We still don't know. We thought it was just a lung disease. Results, it's not. It turns out it can also affect your brain. It can also affect your heart. It can also affect your blood vessels. You know, you don't see as many of those symptoms with the flu. I definitely think, and like I said, the mortality rate of SARS-CoV-2 is much higher. It's just very, very different. And it's a different type of virus. It's a different type of disease. So to me, it cannot be compared. And people will say like, oh, well, people with the flu, like 36,000 people die in average in a year. Yeah, but 200,000 people have died with COVID just in the United States in just a 6 month period. So you cannot compare, you know, the flu and SARS-CoV-2. It's just not, to me, it's not a fair comparison at all.
I have to say, I completely agree with you. And I think you've described that really clearly. With coronavirus, COVID-19, we're seeing, as you highlighted, multi-system involvement, many different parts of our bodies becoming somewhat overwhelmed by either the virus or our own immune system. And there's lots of research going on. And I agree with you, it's an evolving picture. This is completely new. It's new in many different ways and so very different. And it's really great to be talking to a fellow clinician who understands and sees that. Speaking of the multi-system involvement, you mentioned earlier in your story that as time went by, you noticed that you started to get a fast heart rate. How long after the initial infection did you start to notice that?
So that's interesting because I noticed a fast heart rate on day one, but I attributed it to the fever. You know, as a clinician, you know, when you have fever, your heart rate goes up. So when my mind is like, you know, I have a high heart rate, but I have a fever. So they both go hand in hand. I believe I can attribute it to that. Then, you know, didn't check for my heart rate again for about a week. When I exercised, I noticed my heart rate went up too high for what my heart rate normally is when I exercised. And then, you know, that was about a week and a half after that, my heart rate just stayed up the whole time. And I was having horrible, horrible chest pain. You know, I felt like I was having a heart attack. I was having really bad back pain. It felt like, you know, my lungs were aching, like the pleura of my lungs were aching. It didn't feel like a regular back pain. I just felt that it was in my lungs and I felt it in my heart, in my chest. And that's one of the reasons why since from April to June, I believe I visited the ER about 5 times because my heart rate was so high and my chest pain was so bad and the shortness of breath. I was like, am I having a pulmonary embolism? Am I having a heart attack? Like, you know, it's happening in COVID patients. It's happening in young COVID patients who are healthy. So maybe I'm one of those. And I had to visit the ER. And it was very scary because, you know, it's like, oh, your tests are coming back normal. I remember one time where my doctor wouldn't even come in to see me. Like she just from the door, she was like, oh, we got your test back. They're fine. You can go home. Like she wouldn't even come to see me, to hear my heart, to, you know, see how I was doing. And like, I understand everybody was very fearful of this virus, but I felt as a patient just completely ignored and disregarded. I didn't feel like I was like I mattered at the time. Which, you know, was a horrible experience. But like I said, the multiple ER visits, you have to understand it also takes a toll mentally on you because you just, every time you're having chest pain and then you go to seek help and then no one really can tell you. A lot of people are telling you it's anxiety. A lot of people are telling you that this has nothing to do with COVID because we're not seeing this kind of, you know, symptoms with COVID because at the time nobody knew. It was very early on and there was not enough data. There was not enough research that clinicians didn't know that this was a part of COVID or the aftermath of COVID.
Have you had a lot of clinicians that are really unaware of the possibility that this isn't just an acute illness, it can be a long-term, long-haul illness. Have you met clinicians in your journey that really haven't considered that?
So you can have an idea. I have seen 5 different cardiologists. That's right. I've seen 5 different cardiologists. The first one, which I'm very thankful because he was the first doctor who'd actually see me in person after a month of having had COVID. And, you know, he was like, you know, I'm seeing patients. We think it's a multi-inflammatory syndrome, multi-inflammatory response. He sent me a heart monitor and he did an echo, a stress test. Everything came back, you know, normal within what you can expect. He recommended that I keep exercising, just push myself to exercise. And I remember my infectious disease doctor, which I was having telehealth appointments with, was like, please do not exercise. We don't know what the effects of exercise are with this virus. I really, really recommend that you get a second opinion or a third opinion, which I did get a second and third opinion. And they were like, oh, yes, please exercise. It's the thing that's going to get you better. Just exercise, go out for runs, go out for walks, do your normal exercise. And then I saw another cardiologist who was like, you know, I think all you have is anxiety. I don't believe you have anything related to COVID. And at the time, that was my most frustrating visit because I told him, like, listen, I believe I have postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome because I can see in my watch, I can see in my pulse oximeter that when I'm lying down, my heart rate is this. And when I stand up, my heart rate is that. I'm having a decrease initially in blood pressure and then an increase in blood pressure. I have like all the signs and symptoms. I've done the test at home that I believe this is what I have. And he just went on to say, like, I don't think this is happening because of COVID. I also saw a neurologist. Again, he had no idea because I developed some neural symptoms also like month 5 or 4. I went to see a neurologist and he was like, you know, this has nothing to do with COVID. Or your test is fine. Let's do some tests. But, you know, I'm not seeing this with COVID. And I went home, I sent him a bunch of research. And the next time he called me and he was like, I'm very surprised. Like, I really appreciate you sending me this. I had no idea that this was going on with COVID patients. And, you know, now I can have a different approach with my patients. I did tell him, like, you're about to receive a lot of patients consulting post-COVID with neuro symptoms, because this is not just something that's happening to me, but a big percentage of COVID patients out there.
Wow, that's astonishing to think that so many of the clinicians you met directly, and agreed, it's been early. You know, you're among the first patients in the United States. It's astonishing to think that there wasn't an awareness, there wasn't a respect among some of the clinicians that you met, that the symptoms you've been having for months after the initial infection are related to coronavirus. Of course, now, as you say, there is a body of evidence emerging. There are so many patients, as you've highlighted. I'm just glad that you helped to bring awareness to those clinicians the way that you did that, because I hope that will be helpful for a number of different patients. That the fact that you're a clinician speaking to other clinicians, how was that interaction for you?
Well, this is interesting too, because I feel like I definitely had some advantages over other patients. You know the right questions to ask. You know the information. You have the knowledge. You can, you know, debate what your doctor tells you. Versus other patients and maybe don't have the right questions or don't have the right the information, or even they might have information because they've studied it themselves or they've taken it to themselves to just study their disease that they have. But a lot of them won't confront their physicians. They won't confront their doctors about telling them, I don't believe that this is anxiety. I really think I'm sick. And I really think that I should be treated for this, or at least have a study that, you know, if you don't believe I'm sick, maybe we can do some blood work or we can do some imaging. And then we can be sure that I am not sick. Because as a patient, it's so difficult to feel like you're ill and that there's not something is not wrong in your body. And then go to a doctor and not even have a blood test. Like, just have you sent home with no answers at all. Just like the, I believe you're not sick, or I believe you have anxiety. Like, that's not. And as a physician, we always know that anxiety is an exclusion diagnosis. After you've excluded other things is when you can tell a patient they have anxiety, but not before that, not before you have actually investigated that they're not sick. So they extended me a courtesy, which one of the doctors actually told me that, like, I'm going to extend you a clinical or a medical courtesy and have this test sent, or you can have this test done, but I don't believe you have anything. So it's been different. And like I mentioned, that cardiologist that told me I had anxiety, I was like, listen, I've had a fever every single day for 5 months at the time. How is my anxiety causing me to have a fever? Like, that to me makes absolutely no sense. Maybe there's something else going on. Maybe there's something, like you mentioned, the autonomic nervous system that is dysregulated, or some, you know, you cannot just tell me that I don't have anything when I know my body, right? So
I think you've highlighted that really well. And I would add that, in addition to that, as you say, it is an unusual interaction when doctors need doctors, and there can be an interesting difference in dynamic, without doubt. I think we've all experienced that when we've been patients ourselves. But what most concerns me here is that there will be so many vulnerable patients who don't fully understand what's happening to them. They're not as informed as someone like yourself, who's clearly very well read, looking into the latest evidence. And I worry about those vulnerable patients, because if as clinicians we don't take this seriously, this long haul, complex, highly variable condition seriously, well, those patients are in a position of extreme vulnerability, because there is literally no help or support available to them.
And like I mentioned, I think earlier when I mentioned that I saw an infectious disease doctor, and like I said, it was very early on, and they didn't believe that what I had had anything to do with COVID, because it had already been a month and I still have fever, I still have tachycardia. And they were very concerned. That doctor really impacted me, because they were sincerely concerned for my health. But I remember that they told me, like, you either have a bad viral infection, a different virus, or you have cancer, or you have something else. So to hear that also messes with your mental health. Like, you know, she referred me to see a hematologist oncologist, which I went to see. And then I had to sit there, be tested for lymphoma, for leukemia, for any other number of pathologies, and then wait a few days. And now in my head, I think, well, now I have cancer, because obviously this has nothing to do with COVID. And I trust my doctor. And at the time I knew that's the best information she had. And then I had to sit there in the office waiting to hear my results to see if I have cancer or not. Like, that was very... those were very, very dark times, to be honest with you. It was very scary to just sit there and wait to see, do I have this virus or do I have cancer? And like I said, for other people, for other patients that don't even have a lot of the information, they're being sent home without even a test. So it can really, really, I'm sure, that impact them mentally, because... you know, you make them think that they're crazy. They're making up their symptoms, which is obviously not the case.
Yes, I mean, that really highlights how that position is impossible. It's impossible to be, you know, reassured by your clinicians when the clinicians are struggling to understand something that is new, that's something that is rapidly changing. We're all finding that over the last few months. So all of this is very challenging. But equally, you know, as a patient, you're sort of going home and having to make decisions for yourself based on completely inaccurate information, based on the uncertainty of the information, based on the fact that there is no information. Many people in many parts of the world don't have access to adequate testing. So again, they can't be sure that they have coronavirus COVID-19. So there's so much uncertainty, and I think it's very difficult, even with our education, to manage that uncertainty. Even more challenging for the majority of society in a fast-changing, highly unpredictable climate, a global pandemic. And I agree with you. I think the mental health ramifications are huge. I mean, how does one go home and relax? It's just not possible. And quite dissatisfying, I think, clinically. I think you and I could agree that, you know, as providers of healthcare, it's really, really frustrating to know that there are patients out there who aren't sufficiently informed and are not getting, for lots of reasons, not getting the care that they need. In terms of the patient vulnerability and demographics, I was curious to ask you about how things are portrayed in the media in the United States, because you mentioned earlier, before we were recording, the fact that some outlets are sort of, and especially initially, it wasn't just the clinical information that was changing or being updated. There was this message, early message, of the illness being for those at very high risk or those who are older. What's your experience of that?
Well, I don't know about other countries, but here specifically, it's still being portrayed as an old person disease or as a vulnerable person disease, someone who's immunocompromised or has pre-existing condition or is obese or has diabetes or has hypertension or any other number of pathologies. You know, it's being... the media is just portraying it as only those people will die or only those people would get severely sick. And physicians all over the country have seen that's not the case. They have had patients that are 30 on a ventilator or 20 on a ventilator and maybe didn't make it. That's really hard. And I can imagine how draining it can be also for the people in the front lines who are going through that. And, you know, because like I said, we all thought, because that's the information, you know, we were given at the beginning, that only old people die. And to see that you have a 25-year-old patient in a ventilator that might not make it, you know, that's very hard. And day after day, you see more and more healthy with no pre-existing conditions, young patients that get sick. And even if you get a mild infection, even if you didn't get a moderate or severe infection, you know, you get the aftermath, a big percentage. One study said 5 to 15% of people are getting the post-COVID syndrome. Another one said that at least a third of patients will develop post-COVID syndrome. We don't know, but everybody's also focused on the mortality rate, and it's not being talked enough about the post-viral response that a lot of patients are having. And a lot of those patients are young and unhealthy and didn't have pre-existing conditions. So, you know, I'm very fortunate and grateful that I didn't die, but I'm not living my life. I feel like this is someone else's life. I just don't feel like myself. I don't remember what being healthy feels like. It's definitely a misconception that only old people will die. And I've seen old people who have been in a ventilator and have made it, or someone who was immunocompromised and was asymptomatic. You just don't know what you're going to get, you know, regardless of, it's like a lottery, regardless of your age. Yes, of course, some people are more vulnerable and will have a higher risk, but it doesn't mean that someone that doesn't have that risk is not going to get it, or it's not going to get it severely, or it's not going to get a post-viral syndrome. Like, we just don't know. And this time I won the lottery, you know, I would have never thought, not in a million years, I thought I would have been like in this boat where I am right now.
I'm so sorry to hear that you are in this boat, and the uncertainty that this brings, as you've highlighted, for the future is extremely challenging to even consider. It really resonated with me when you just said that you struggle to remember how things were before COVID-19, how much your life has changed. And I think that is taken for granted among those out there that don't really respect this disease. They kind of just sort of assume it's mild, that, you know, it sort of won't happen to me mentality. With that in mind, have you seen or experienced that, maybe around sort of mass culture and social distancing? How's the situation near you? What have you heard?
It's incredible, because to this day I hear comments like, oh, me and my family, 10 members of my family, we all got sick, and, you know, we all had mild infection and nothing happened. It was just like the flu. And I just think to myself, you know what? You are so lucky, and you should be so grateful that that was the case for your family. Whereas I see other family who they've lost 5 or 6 people from the same member of the family because of the virus. And I think especially like in this country, people are not taking it maybe serious enough, or there's a denial that there's a pandemic going on. There is not a mass culture happening. It's such an easy way to stop the spread. People are looking for a miracle cure when you could do the simple thing of just wearing a mask. I heard that one person, their city had a burn your mask day, which I just thought it was unbelievable that, you know, they would have such a massive event of everybody. To me, it's like a symbolic of, you know, there's nothing going on, and then these don't work, or, you know, it's like, maybe you would do it for, like, I think it's like human decency. Like, maybe if you don't think you're going to get sick, or you don't believe it yourself, you know, do it for others. And you see that it's not mandatory. When it probably should be, you know, we have so many things that are mandatory. Like, you know, when the school, you have to wear a uniform, or a public school, you cannot wear a skirt above your knee, or you cannot wear, if you're a boy, you cannot wear long hair. It has to be this short, or your cleavage has to be this much. But at the same time, you're not making them, or the masks are not mandatory. So you can definitely tell them how to dress, but you cannot tell them to wear a mask. To me, that makes absolutely no sense, because one is a matter of public health, you know, wearing a mask, a matter of public health and having, you know, not spread the virus. And the other one is just a matter of I guess, discipline. And like when you tell the kids how to, you know, dress, and there's also a misconception of kids don't get sick. Yes, it's way less likely for kids to get sick. And, you know, but they can get sick. And I've also seen long haulers, 9-year-old long haulers. You imagine having a 9-year-old daughter or son or a 3-year-old, and you have to put them on a heart monitor and send them to school with their heart monitor they have to wear for a week, or, you know, that they develop an atrial fibrillation. You know, it's so hard and draining for a parent, for a kid, to be going through that when it all can be prevented. And, you know, there's also this multisystem inflammatory syndrome that also happens. You know, it's very rare, but it also happens, and it's very severe in kids. There's a high mortality rate. So, you know, to me, everybody should be taking this seriously, not just old people or adults, you know, kids too. Like, everybody should be trying to protect themselves.
Absolutely. I think you're right. You're highlighting that there needs to be more done in terms of looking after society. And what an interesting concept, the double standards of having to wear certain uniforms in certain situations, yet not including an item of really straightforward, simple item of, which could be uniform, if you like, a face mask, simply because some people question, you know, whether it's necessary. There is no doubt that face masks are of benefit if used correctly. There's been plenty of evidence to suggest this. And I just think it's outrageous that we can have, as you highlighted, standards for how we dress at school, but for some reason we're uncomfortable with mandating masks. And I think in certain situations, it's entirely appropriate to look after the people around you in a public environment. And we do see this in other cultures. There are many cultures around the world where absolutely, you wouldn't think twice about wearing a mask. And I'm really struggling with the fact that some of the countries that are worst hit by coronavirus are often the countries that have kind of the sort of these double standards in their policies. And it's really, really sad to see that. Such simple things could be preventing these long-term health concerns, at least helping. And any help in this situation has to be a good thing. I'm sure we're on the same page there.
Yes. And even places where they're mandated, you know, there's a store and you have, if you want, you know, certain states, obviously, if you want to do grocery shopping or you want to go into the store, the mask is mandated. But then there's still people like disregarding the rules and just wearing the mask, you know, with their nose out, or just wearing the mask in their chins, or just wearing it as a bandana or something. And, you know, you ask them, or the people at the store ask them, can you please put your mask on? Because it's a rule for a store. If you don't want to wear a mask, like, we understand, but just don't come to our store, you know. But if you're here, you have to, you know, abide by the rules that we have. And it's just like the disregard for other people's well-being and feelings. And, you know, because you don't believe in something, it doesn't mean that it's not there. And, you know, you have to just respect other people's health and beliefs as well.
Absolutely. I think we're all in this together. And I've said numerous times in this video series that we need to look after society. This isn't about individual preferences anymore. This is about doing what we need to do in order to protect those around us. And even if you make a good example with the stores, even if in the store you're looking out for the people who work at that store because they are keeping the economy going, they're keeping supplies going, they're looking after society and their own contribution, I think we just have an absolute obligation to look after those store workers, for example, let alone all the other people who want to do their shopping at the same time. And to you and I think that seems fairly straightforward. And I'm really looking forward to the day when many societies kind of latch onto that concept. Some have, of course, and in certain circles, it's totally routine. And I hope that there will be some trends in that direction in the places where, for some reason, masks are still not worn universally. Your story is just amazing in many ways. I'm genuinely sorry to hear that you still have symptoms this far on since March. This is very much about your messages, and I'd like you to share any other thoughts or guidance for those out there that really may not be as informed as we would hope. What else would you like to share?
I think I just want to, you know, say that there's still a lot more to learn about this virus. Nobody has the last word on this. Nobody is an expert on SARS-CoV-2. Nobody can tell you that they know what it causes and what it cannot cause, because we still, like I mentioned at the beginning, it's still evolving and we still don't know for sure. So, you know, for patients who are dealing or who are long haulers and dealing with symptoms, to like push your doctors, you know, do your own research. You know, as a physician, we don't like when obviously patients Google their symptoms, because Google is the worst doctor and it will always tell you that you're going to die. You have the worst thing, you know, that's not, but doing appropriate research as a patient, you know, always helps, because this is all new, you know, and we don't know a lot of, like I said, a lot of doctors out there still don't know what's going on. So for them, I would really advise to, you know, stay up to date with the things that are happening. I can only imagine how hard it must be for a clinician nowadays, because they're overworked, overwhelmed by everything that's going on around them and all the patients they have seen. But, you know, it's also a responsibility with the patient that you have to stay up to date and informed to what's going on so you can help them. I know all we want to do is help the patients, you know, that's what we're here for. Also, I really wish more people would just wear a mask and, you know, definitely don't think that you're making up your symptoms or that you're crazy, because, you know, that's not the case. This is very real. This is happening. You know, 6 months in, I am still sick, that I spend a lot of my time in bed. You know, I have to push myself to do things and get out of my bed, because it's hard. It's very, very hard, especially after having such an active lifestyle, you know, an adventurous lifestyle, and then going through this, you know, chronically ill phase of my life. Also, I really encourage everyone to do a mental health check, because sometimes it's not talked about enough. And to this day, 2020 is still kind of taboo to talk about mental health. And it's not acceptable to say you have anxiety or you have depression. You know, I really encourage patients, especially dealing with a long haulers or a post-viral response this long on, to please seek help and definitely talk about that. And for people who still maybe are not aware that this is not a 2-week illness, to really keep into consideration that it is, and that it can be a month long illness, or it can be a 6 month long illness, or who knows, you know. At this point, if I am told you're going to be sick for one more year, but then you're going to be healthy, I'll take it. I would be more than happy with that. But I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to recover to go back to my old self or not. So I'm definitely be grateful for health. You know, we really don't understand how lucky we are by being healthy. We always just take it for granted. And I really wish, like, more than anything, like, I could just be healthy right now. And, you know, it doesn't matter if I don't have anything else, but just be healthy. And that would be the best thing that could happen to me this year.
Laura, I wish the same. I really hope that your health returns, that you can get back to jiu-jitsu and all the exercise and all the work that you do, looking after patients again. I want that more than anything. And I do genuinely thank you. I wish you the very best for the future. I hope that your husband makes a good recovery too. I think, in summary of what you've said, is clearly we have a role to play as clinicians, staying up to date, sharing that uncertainty with society, but carefully. And in society, we've got a huge role to play as well. Maybe we can work together, look after one another. Maybe that sounds idealized, but I think there are some simple things that we can all do in order to reduce the risk of long haul COVID, reduce the transmission, because I don't want to see more people in these scenarios. And again, I hope that things do start to improve for you. And again, thank you so very much for being so honest in this discussion.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and allowing me to share my story. I think I want to make one last point because you just reminded me of it. Just one message for clinicians I would like to say is like, don't be afraid to tell your patient that you don't know. Because as a patient, you are more than okay to hear that I don't know, let's figure it out together, than just a plain, you're fine, there's nothing wrong with you. That's like the last message I would like to leave out there.
Thank you for listening. Please like and share this story widely, as it may support other long haulers. I wish you well.